Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Two teenage survivors of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, died by suicide within a week of one another. 19-year-old Sydney Aiello was a senior during the massacre. Her friend Meadow Pollack was killed. Sydney's mom told CBS Miami that she struggled with survivor's guilt and was recently diagnosed with PTSD. The name of the other student has not been released. Florida's emergency management director, who is also a former state representative from Parkland, has called on the state to provide more mental health services for the community. Olympic cyclist and Stanford graduate student Kelly Caitlin died by suicide on March 7th. Her father, Mark, told the San Francisco Chronicle that after a previous attempt and week-long hospital stay, his daughter was not able to see her preferred campus psychiatrist because he was backlogged with cases until May. These deaths highlight a shortage of care that so many people with mental health issues face in this country. Accessing services can be incredibly difficult or impossible. According to Mental Health America, almost 57% of adults with a mental illness receive no treatment, whether out of an inability to pay for services, a lack of providers, or for many other reasons. More than 24 million people experiencing a mental health illness are going untreated. So what explains this? How did we get here? And what are advocates doing to improve access? Today, we're joined by Kelly Davis, Director of Peer Advocacy Support and Services at Mental Health America. That's a community-based nonprofit dedicated to addressing the needs of those living with mental illnesses and to promoting the mental health of all Americans. Kelly's lived experience with mental health diagnoses and trauma are at the center of her passion for transforming how we support individuals and change systems and services. Hi, Kelly. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. We're also joined by Peter Murphy, Outreach Coordinator for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, which operates the city's Warm Line. It is a peer-run, non-emergency resource for anyone in the Bay Area seeking emotional support. And the number is 415-421-1880. Hi, Peter. Thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks very much for having me. This is a great opportunity. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And this is a really hard show for me to host because it's a very personal experience. I have been trying to help a loved one get mental health help for the last 9 months, and it has been so incredibly, it's probably the hardest thing I've ever done, so incredibly difficult and frustrating. We just keep hitting walls. And I'm a very good researcher, and so I just have to wonder, for people who do not have an advocate and don't have resources, how do they get by? So I want to ask you both a pretty big question. Kelly Davis, why is it so difficult to get help? I mean, the numbers are just shocking. 24 million people who have a mental health illness are not getting treatment.
Yeah, I mean, that is a really big question. And I think it really goes back to what we have now is essentially a crisis-based system of services, if you can call it that. So we really, and MHA's guiding philosophy, what we talk about in our national office is this idea of before stage four, which is that mental health conditions are the only chronic health conditions that we wait until a point of crisis to deal with. And for a lot of people, because we haven't treated mental health as a really important issue, we just haven't built out the infrastructure to support people. So many people go without nothing and then have to get to the point where they're hospitalized or die by suicide, which is increasingly happening, or what we're seeing with the opioid crisis, before they get anything at all. So there's a lot in there. Part of it is insurance coverage. Part of it is a big behavioral health workforce shortage, and just the lack of a comprehensive way we think about people and what might support them as entire people, instead of waiting until it gets so bad that we have a crisis.
And we should say that when we talk about the 24 million individuals who are going untreated, that number has not declined since 2011. So, Peter, what would you add?
Well, I agree for sure with Kelly that There's a tremendous, there's a tremendous amount of stigma around around mental health still, and I think that definitely can be a barrier for individuals in looking for treatment. Also, I would add that sometimes the first treatment a person might get, unfortunately, is through law enforcement. I mean, I know one example is in Cook County in Illinois, where their penal system is the biggest mental health service in the area. So there's a lot of folks that have mental health challenges are ending up getting arrested, and before they've even had any kind of chance to have support or the services that they might need, that's their introduction to it. And I think that's really, really unfortunate.
And there are a lot of amazing organizations like Mental Health America, like the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. But what I found is the system is very difficult to navigate if you're completely new to this. I mean, learning about the differences between a psychiatrist and a psychologist and a marriage and family therapist, and learning, you know, what person is covered by Medicare and what person is not. I mean, it's very hard to just get answers to that very basic information. So Kelly, for people who might be experiencing, say, depression, anxiety, or maybe helping someone in the very beginning stages, what steps should they take to get the help that they need so they don't have to spend months and months and months just hitting walls?
Yeah, that's something that we've seen a lot too. So at MHA, at least for us, we have an online screening program. And as part of that, we offer a lot of information about all of the things that come up for people. So what do I need to know about insurance? How do I find a provider? What are the differences between all of the providers? And I think another piece is, well, part of it is that that's how a lot of this stuff continues to happen, is that things are so fragmented that people kind of give up because it's so challenging to get anywhere. And one of the really awesome things, and I think, you know, the Warm Line is a great example of this, is I work in peer advocacy, and peer support specialists are people with lived experience who are able to help people not only with just emotional support, having been there themselves, but they're also able to answer questions and help people navigate the system and provide that kind of information. So things like the Warm Line out of San Francisco, or any community-based organizations like a National Alliance on Mental Illness, a Mental Health America, a Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, having the information from the communities is really helpful. And I think there's an increasing number of insurers who are understanding this idea that it's actually more expensive to wait until the crisis point. So they're also starting to provide more case management and comprehensive coordination services as well.
Peter, the Warm Line is such an incredible resource in the Bay Area. Again, it's a peer-run, non-emergency resource for anyone in the Bay Area seeking emotional support. And the number is 415-421-1880. Tell us just a little bit about how the Warm Line operates.
Definitely. Thanks, Rose. The Warm Line, well, it's been in existence since August of 2014. And over that time, through July of last year, we were funded by a workforce development grant, which allowed us to, at our peak, to have 24/7 service, and to be able to compensate our peer counselors. And Kelly did a really good job of describing what the peer counselors, what they offer. I've been on the phone line myself. I'm doing outreach now, but I identify as a peer with lived experience. And as Kelly mentioned, we provide resources for and referrals to whoever calls in. But I think the most valuable thing, perhaps, is being able to share our lived experience and to really help anyone calling in to feel less isolated around what they're facing, and maybe to also refer to your question about the frustrations. I mean, someone that's having a mental health episode or is going through something it's going to be that much harder for them to navigate the system. I mean, I think as you found, Rose, it can be really challenging when you're at your peak performance. But if you're not doing well and you're trying to do it on your own, it's very daunting and frustrating. And I feel like one of the things the Warm Line really provides as well, we provide hope. Many times, I've taken many, many calls. We keep records. I've taken thousands of calls on the Warm Line. And I think one of the biggest things we can offer, it's like, wow, so you called in today. You know, that's great, because a lot of our callers are pretty hopeless. And, you know, they may feel like they've kind of run through their support system and their resources. And the Warm Line is a low-threshold support service, meaning anyone with a phone or access to the internet. We also have internet messaging. People can contact us that way as well. And we're in the process now of trying to expand our services. We're currently able to serve the nine Bay Area counties, but we're in the process of trying to expand that to the entire state of California.
You brought up a number of things there, Peter. Do we have any idea what percentage of people with a mental health illness are trying to get services on their own? Because like you said, I mean, this is not a full-time job. I mean, trying to get my loved one help, you're constantly on the phone. I mean, any moment I have that's free, I'm calling people back, you know, calling a therapist from 3 months ago. Okay, do you now have room? Because the fact of the matter is, the first therapist might not work. I mean, they just might not work together. And so do we know how many people are trying to do this on their own? Because that's just got to be so incredibly difficult.
I can't really speak to the numbers. I'm not sure how readily available that information is. My experience, I guess, would be more anecdotally. And I feel like I run into it all the time. I mean, where there's, wow. There's frustrations and I've been in your spot too. I mean, I have loved ones as well. So that also have challenges. And so not only, I mean, looking for myself and trying to help them and the system that we have is not, it can be really overwhelming.
Kelly, do you know how many people are doing this on their own? I mean, is it a large chunk of people?
So I don't have any official numbers, but as anecdotally, many, many people. And in our report that came out, The State of Mental Health in America, 20% of the people who were interviewed said that they weren't able to receive the treatment they needed. So it's likely a lot more than that, though. I know, you know, you both talked about your experience. I share similar experiences in terms of trying to find, you know, when you're looking for any kind of specialty support or anything beyond your initial conversation that might not work out is like, it's for many people a luxury to say, well, this didn't work, let me find somebody else. And like I mentioned before, many people give up, so we don't necessarily have those numbers. There's an organization called the Kennedy Forum that is led by Patrick Kennedy, and they have a large campaign on denials and trying to figure out how insurers are denying people the services that they deserve. So they might have more of that data because they're at least working to see in the instances where people have reached out for help when they're not getting it. Because of insurance, but I would imagine it's a very significant number of people who just, you know, either cannot find anything or end up giving up or end up in the hospital or, you know, as mentioned, in prison or jail.
You know, I think what would be so helpful is if there was a resource that you could go to online or call to say, okay, can you please explain to me what are the steps I should take? You know, what are the differences between a psychiatrist and a psychologist? What does Medicare cover? Because Medicare does not cover family and marriage counseling. They do cover psychologists and psychiatrists, but you learn this along the way. So Kelly, do you know of any resource that just gives you that very basic information in an easy to understand manner?
So in terms, you know, it's very different having reading it online and having somebody explain it to you. So one of the other large national nonprofits is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and they actually have a helpline. So if you reach out to NAMI.org, they have people who can talk to you on the phone about the different things that might be covered and the different steps that you should take. But it's also helpful to, I think, reach out to the local folks too, because a lot of things are different depending on where you are in the country. So there's plenty of areas rural areas where there's really almost nothing for people. And even in heavily populated areas, there's still often not a lot available.
Well, that's the other thing I've been thinking about, because I'm trying to get someone help in Sonoma County and just Northern California in general, which is a very resource-rich place. And if it's that hard here, I often wonder, what is it like in rural areas or, you know, states with very few resources?
Definitely. I might add something. I think locally when we get these kind of calls, NAMI is a great resource, as Kelly mentioned. But also, every county has a behavioral health access department. So that would be like a starting point for someone looking for services. That can be one of those kind of challenging calls to make. I mean, in the sense that they do their best to support the person, but it can be challenging depending, I think, on who they get to have worked with them. And we were talking about the Warm Line as a resource. We're really interested in by expanding to the state of to the entire state, to be able to reach those more remote areas where there aren't readily available resources, because being isolated like that is definitely a barrier to getting very good treatment.
And as you said, Peter, the Warm Line was received a grant from the San Francisco Health Department. It was a 3-year state grant that supported it was $1.4 million a year, and the grant expired in March of last year, and rollover funds that supported the line's survival were scheduled to run out by the end of June last year. So have you been funded? Are you working with any resources, financial, monetary?
Yes, we are. We're actually funded right now by the Department of Public Health of San Francisco, which we really appreciate. But it's limited funding, which allows us to pay some administrative staff. But our line is staffed by volunteers now who were able to give. I feel like we can give them really great training, and they do a really good job. They are peer counselors, but it does really limit our hours. So we went from being 24/7 to right now we're at 36 hours a week. So it's pretty limited. We do return calls if somebody calls into us at that number you gave, 415-421-1880. So if someone were to leave us a message, provided that they're within the 9 Bay Area counties that we serve. So the county is right around San Francisco. We are in the process right now. I'm sorry.
What time are you open at this point? What time do you take calls?
Our schedule is Sunday, Monday, Tuesday from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m., Wednesday 2 to 6, and then Thursday 1 to 9 p.m. So we're closed on Friday and Saturday.
Kelly, I have to ask you, we're talking now about San Francisco, one of the wealthiest, most expensive states in the country, and you're hearing what happened with the Warm Line. They had to cut down on hours, and their clinicians who are helping people are doing it on a volunteer basis.
Yeah, and that's, we're seeing even worse things in many other places in the country. I know I can talk from my lived experience. I grew up in Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia area and was so horrified by how, and all the things that I had to deal with, that I moved to DC and I was like, I'm going to come fix everything and work with everybody, and found out Pennsylvania is one of the best places in the country for you to be. So even in the places that are the best, it's bad. That's kind of the nuance that we provide when we, in our report where we rank the states on different measures, is that even the states who are the highest ranked are not doing a good job. In terms of more rural areas, one of the things that is happening a lot is a switch towards telehealth. So using technology, whether that's video conferencing, whether it's phone calls, whether it's texting, both in rural areas and non-rural areas, is one of the ways that we're trying to get more support to people who, for whatever reason, whether it's there's no one physically close to them, the times are convenient, or they just don't want to be somewhere in person, telehealth and digital health technology are going to be a big part of filling a gap, especially in a broader context of such a small workforce.
Kelly Davis is Director of Peer Advocacy Support and Services at Mental Health America. It's a community-based nonprofit dedicated to addressing the needs of those living with a mental illness. We're also joined by Peter Murphy, Outreach Coordinator for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, which operates the city's Warm Line, a peer-run non-emergency resource for anyone in the Bay Area seeking emotional support. That number is 415-421-1880. We should also give out the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 800-273-8255, and they are available 24 hours a day, 800-273-8255. There's also the crisis text line for people who would rather text, and this is also free 24/7 support. You can text the word HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741. Text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about what it will take to improve access to mental health services, we'd love to hear from you. If you have sought mental health support, what has your experience been like? What services did you get? How did that help you? If you work in mental health care and you'd like to share a story or talk about what you would like to see change, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So why don't we talk about what it would take to change the system now? We usually try to talk about changing things at the end of the show, but I think it's really important to do that now. Kelly, what changes are you seeing across the country? And I mean, what will it take to ensure that people can get the help that they need? I mean, what are some of the top changes you would like to see?
So there's certainly a lot there. Part of it is making sure that insurers are fully covering mental health services at parity in the same way that they cover any other physical health services. Part of it is investing in the behavioral health workforce shortage. So making sure there are enough psychiatrists, making sure there are enough social workers, and also expanding peer support services that we've been talking about so far is, you know, many folks will go to their primary care office and they'll mostly work with nurses because we're seeing that task shifting is a really good way to help people and expand the availability of the workforce. So having peers come in as a growing workforce and fill some of the gaps that, you know, so that professionals can do what they do and peers can do more of teaching people skills, connecting people to supports, building community. And then even more broadly, you know, working with people one-on-one is really, really important, and we need to make sure that's all available. But we also have to think more broadly because it's such a deep systemic problem. So that means working with schools to make them more mentally healthier, working in workplaces to make them more mentally healthier, working in primary care, which is where most people are seeking behavioral health services, and then more broadly addressing the social determinants of health. So there's many social issues that impact mental health and well-being, and insurers, both in public mental health but also private mental health, are starting to see, oh, you know, housing is important to mental health outcomes. Working with pregnant women is important to mental health outcomes. Addressing trauma is important. So there's a lot of different things, and it's in a broader context where we need to be meeting people earlier and in more inclusive ways that don't separate their mental health or mental health condition from the rest of their lives.
Well, let's continue talking about that after a break, especially staffing and what it would take to increase the number of psychologists, therapists, and psychiatrists across the country. That's Kelly Davis. She's Director of Peer Advocacy, Support, and Services at Mental Health America. Peter Murphy is Outreach Coordinator for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, which operates the city's Warm Line. It's a peer-run, non-emergency resource for anyone in the Bay Area seeking emotional support. The number is 415-421-1880. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. And the crisis text line is text HOME to 741-741. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about taxes and how tax burdens have changed and where our tax dollars are going. Of the 35 richest countries in the world, the United States ranks 32nd in total tax burden, according to the journalist T.R. Reid. The only countries that pay less in taxes are Mexico and Chile. We'll talk about that tomorrow, and then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation about mental health care and what it will take to ensure that more people have access to mental health services, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a personal story to share, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Or if you just have a basic question about how to navigate the system, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by Peter Murphy, Outreach Coordinator for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, which operates the city's Warm Line, a peer-run non-emergency resource. The number is 415-421-1880. Kelly Davis is Director of Peer Advocacy, Support, and Services at Mental Health America. Kelly's lived experience with mental health and trauma are at the center of her passion for transforming how we support people and change systems and services. Kelly, before the break, you were saying that, well, you were just talking about the lack of providers. Can you talk about that more? Because what I have found up in Sonoma County, where we've had a lot of fires, is I've talked to a lot of therapists and psychologists who say that people have such long-term PTSD because of the fires, and so they're not having much turnover, and that's why they have long waiting lists. And they're all so frustrated that it's so hard to find help, and they're doing what they can, but they can only take so many patients.
Absolutely. Well, I think some of that goes back to the stigma that came up earlier, as mental health related professions aren't, especially in the medical doctor field, aren't as respected as other types of doctors. But I think increasingly more people are coming to the field. But part of what we have to do is support people in educational attainment, make the field more attractive to folks who would want to help and would want to serve in this capacity. But then also one of the major issues that doesn't put people in the field is the reimbursement from insurers. So the insurance reimbursement for mental health professionals is lower than for other health professionals. And what's happened is that because they're not being paid well, one, people aren't going into the field, but two, providers are not accepting insurance and people are forced to pay out of pocket or do nothing. So part of it is making the field more attractive. And oftentimes, as with other things, that's about adequately reimbursing people for the services they're providing. And again, it's such a dire need that we are going to have to be really creative in getting as many people engaged in new ways as possible.
Well, let's take a call from a psychiatrist in San Francisco who's calling in. Let's hear from Dr. Fisher. Hi, Dr. Fisher. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for calling in.
So I really appreciate all the comments that everyone's made. Piggybacking what Kelly just mentioned about kind of the issues of reducing stigma and the challenges of kind of the supply and the and demand, the lack of supply of psychiatrists. I'll just comment that I was in medical school 20 years ago, and when everyone said, oh, what field are you going into, everyone was really proud to say, oh, orthopedic surgery, or I'm going to be a neurosurgeon. But, the four of us in our class that said, oh, psychiatry, they said, oh, really? So, stigma starts at all different levels, and unfortunately, that is throughout our communities. It goes through our cultures. It goes through our country. So really, I think targeting awareness on all levels of just, cutting through it so we can really just help people is really going to be an important factor. I also wanted to just briefly comment that I think identification of symptoms is really an earlier step that we need to look at, because I think there are many people that suffer from mental illness and they don't really know that they suffer from mental illness. They don't know what a panic attack is. They don't know what depression is. They aren't familiar with in the same way that people promote, oh, these are signs and symptoms of a stroke, or these are signs and symptoms of a heart attack. No one knows the signs or symptoms of a panic attack. And so I think the personal identification of our own, disorders per se, is really crucial, because how can I ask for help if I don't even know what's going on? And that's
right.
Yeah. So I wanted to comment
That is a huge one. And Dr. Fisher, can I ask you, since you're a psychiatrist, I was under the impression that if you went to a psychiatrist, you would be prescribed a drug if needed, and you would also get talk therapy. But what I have come to learn is that you don't get talk therapy from a psychiatrist. So you have to see a psychiatrist if you think you need medication, and then you also have to go to a therapist or a psychologist. Is that the case really nationwide now, and did that change?
Decades ago, I think the stereotypical psychiatrist would have you on the couch, 4 days a week, and minimally prescribe medications, and through the 80s and 90s and the kind of the real push of pharma, and integrating kind of, let's go for the quick pill response, it's been pushed. Also, I think just in terms of resources, there are more therapists per se available than psychiatrists, MD per se. I personally do provide therapy and medication, many of my colleagues do not. And sometimes there's so many different factors that come into play, but I don't necessarily think that there is anything, preferred way. I personally have a preference, but, if someone has a separate therapist and sees me for medication management on a less frequent basis, I can certainly work. But you're right, it there has been a push for the medical doctor to prescribe the medication and a non-medical provider to do the therapy.
Well, thank you for your work, Dr. Fisher, and thank you for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Let's go to our next caller, Barbara in San Francisco. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Rose. I just wanted to mention that a lot of times people who are looking for answers on where to go to get therapy and or what about medication come to a national organization which has a local branch in San Francisco called the Depression Bipolar Support Alliance. And they have meetings on Monday nights and Saturday afternoons at St. Francis Hospital. And individuals who are interested can go and look up dbsasf.org and find out information about the group and about where it meets. And it's all peer-led. So individuals who are in the group either have direct experience with being bipolar 1 or 2 and or depressed. And so a lot of people are at varying stages. Some of them are at the beginning of their journey for getting help, and others are well-experienced and have many years of experience in medications, psychiatrists, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a good support group for individuals who want to learn more from people who have been down that road and who have gotten help for their mental health. And it's a good place for people to share without judgment their process and where they are, and get advice from people who have been there longer, perhaps, or been more knowledgeable about their own mental health issues. And they're asking for a donation, so it's really free to go, and it's a good space for people to be in.
Wow, thank you so much. I just looked at the website, Barbara. This looks like an incredible resource and a group that we might invite on a future show. This is the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, dbsalliance.org, and then you just type in your zip code to find a group in your area. And I know that a lot of our listeners are not online, so I also want to give out the phone number. It's 800-826-3632, 800-826-3632. Thank you so much, Barbara. That's a great resource.
Yeah, and local website is dbsasf.org.
Okay. Thank you so much, Barbara. We'll also link at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Howard in San Jose. Hi, Howard. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say I've been acting as support for people who've had to go through the mental health care system especially in San Francisco. And I just want to say it's really great that we're talking about like being able to educate people and empathize with their problems. But I also want to like note the ugly part of this, which is that in general, people don't like people who have mental health problems. Like, I've had to witness it firsthand where somebody's friends like completely abandon them because they start talking about their problems. Or they'll say they'll be there for them, but then when things really get difficult, they're just gone. And accessing the actual mental health system part has also been very difficult. Most of the people I'm working with are pretty young, and people working for disability agents think that they're just trying to fleece money off the government by pretending to have mental illness. Mm-hmm. Or they're acting difficult on purpose, or they're faking it or something like that. So, and then of course, if we're just talking about the media in general, anytime mental health comes up, and it's always in the context of some kind of terrorist attack or a shooter or something, it's not very pretty. And I also want to say that I've been really unfortunate to have to hear from healthcare providers themselves when they get very frustrated that they will admit to me that they don't like their patients. They don't like how they're acting.
Wow. Well, you brought up a number of... Thank you, Howard. And you brought up a number of important points there. Peter, what about Howard's comment about how it's for some people, they say that they'll help and then they don't. I mean, this is new for a lot of people. If you know, even family members, in many cases, they don't know how to deal with this.
Definitely. We find that on the warm line, I'd say pretty regularly. What I've told the callers that we've had is that actually a service like that we provide, we can be there for the person, maybe when their family and friends just don't know what to do or can't be. You know, I mean, I know in my own experience, like I might put a lot of pressure, say, on my partner or a relative and feel like, well, you know, you need to understand everything that's happening with me. And maybe to some extent that's unrealistic. I think people, they can still love their relatives and care for them and just be, as a lot of us are, just uncertain about what the next best thing is to do. So I encourage callers or our callers to use the warm line of support and find peers like we mentioned DBSA, the support group that was mentioned earlier. That's a place where peers can get together and share ways to support each other.
You just remind me of another resource I want to share with people. It's called Village to Village Network. It's an amazing organization. I'm sorry, it's called the Village Network. Amazing organization that it's $30 to $50 a month. You can get 3 rides a week. People will come to visit you twice a week. If you want to have a phone call to just interact with someone, you can also do that. They've got activities like chair yoga, movie night, you know, just getting together so people are socially active, because we're just learning more about how important that is. And I know about the one in up north, Village Network of Petaluma is doing amazing work, but we will also put a link to the Village Network on our website so you can find one in your area if you think that would be helpful. And thank you for calling in, Howard. We have an email from Robert who says, what happened to the concept of community mental health that was promoted in the early 70s when the shift was to close large mental hospitals and create more community mental health centers for easy access? Can you answer that question, Kelly?
I can. And what we've been talking about with the peer movement, a lot of this goes back to the civil rights movement and massive deinstitutionalization, as people around the country were seeing how horrible conditions were in the state institutions and the human rights violations that were happening there. And the idea was that we would release people from the institutions and shift services into the communities so people could live lives with dignity in the ways that they want to. And in the 1980s, in the Reagan administration, much of that funding was gutted. And what we're seeing is that people are either getting no services, or people are homeless, or people are incarcerated, when really the answer isn't to put people in institutions, it's to provide them comprehensive resources in the community. And a lot of that is funding and bringing people together to push for these on the state, local, and federal level.
Hmm. Well, what would you add, Peter?
There are community resources available, at least in San Francisco, but I feel like, I think like Kelly was saying, that they're not as robust as we would like, and for the reasons that Kelly's mentioned. One thing I wanted to add is, we've talked about peer recovery, which I think is great, and we're trying to find a way. I mean, our agency, the Mental Health Association of San Francisco, we're all about peer recovery. And we're working to find ways that peers can better interact with the system that does exist. Dr. Fisher mentioned earlier, there are psychiatrists and therapists and counselors that are providing care. And then, like, how do we integrate peers into that model to provide a more comprehensive support system? Like we were saying, I mean, psychiatrists and services in the medical community can be pretty limited, and I feel like peers, including what the Warm Line offers, we try to fill in the gaps where there's support that's missing.
I also want to talk about emergency services. Over the last 3 years, the National Council for Behavioral Health reported a 42% increase in the use of these emergency services for mental health treatment. And I just want to give a personal example. I won't name the hospital, but I called a major hospital with an outpatient program that I thought would maybe work for my loved one. And I left them 4 messages, never got a call back. So I went directly to the psychiatric department at this hospital in person, and I said, you know, I'm desperate. I need help. What should I do? And they told me to admit my loved one to the emergency room. And I said, the emergency room? And they said, we're so overwhelmed, and we have a social worker in our emergency room, and that is your best option at this point. I was shocked to hear that, Kelly. I mean, especially in San Francisco.
Yeah, that is...
How common is that?
It's pretty common. I think that's kind of bringing it back to the before stage 4 philosophy that we talk about at MHA, is that for many people, because we're not investing in prevention, we're not investing in early identification, which is not only teaching people what to look for, but also how to support one another. You know, it's both of those things, is because we're not building all of these things beforehand. That's the only place people can go. And then a lot of times, they're given that advice, is if you want them to get access to services, having them hospitalized will put them in the front of the list. And that's, you know, the best we can do for you because we have such a long waiting list. And on the other side, for people who, and, you know, there's a lot of traumatization and people aren't treated well in the emergency departments very often. And the staff there aren't trained on how to support them. But then on the other side, if you're not, you know, and if you're not ending up on inpatient, they're just sending people off. And many of them don't have any follow-up within the next month. And they're not, you know, there's nobody there sitting with them saying, okay, this is what's happening now. This is what's available to you. These are the different decisions that you could make. I'm going to sit with you and help you throughout the process. Because it shouldn't just be, you have to show up at an emergency department. We admit you for however long we can. And then on the other end, just leave and we're giving you nothing. Is, you know, we need more mental health professionals and peers in the emergency departments for when it gets to that point.
Wow. The other thing is, I was told to go early in the morning because it just becomes too chaotic during the day. So, well, I mean, like you said, the treatment from emergency room to emergency room is different, but I've heard that it's actually a pretty traumatizing experience. What happens after that? Then does someone finally get the help that they need if they admit themselves to the ER?
It depends, with a lot of these things. So you could end up in an inpatient stay. You can end up somewhere for, you know, a few days. Many inpatient psychiatric units are pretty, like, they're thought of as crisis stabilization. So people are there for, you know, 7 to 10 days or sometimes 3 days and then sent off without a real discharge plan, without real connections to community-based resources. And that's why we see such high rates of rehospitalization. You're actually at the highest risk for suicide in the weeks following being released from an inpatient psychiatric stay. So we really, for people who get into services, we're really not, none of this is comprehensive, right? It's all piecemeal and there's nobody helping people coordinate things. You're kind of left on your own. And for people who have no advocates, right? Like, it's really hard on the family, but then for people who have no advocates, who don't understand insurance, who don't understand any of this, they're really left on their own.
Mm. Kelly Davis is with Mental Health America, and Peter Murphy is with the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. They operate the city's Warm Line, a peer-run non-emergency resource for people in the Bay Area. We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to make sure we get to as many calls and emails as we can. We have an email from Lynn who says, please tell your listeners about the Greenlight Clinic, a free mental health clinic started by Marjorie Swig for youth from 14 to 25 in the Presidio in San Francisco. It offers free 50-minute sessions for 6 months, referrals to low-fee area clinics, and continuing booster sessions to ensure patients' long-term stability. And here's the information, greenlightclinic.org. The number is 415-742-4306. I know that the Well Clinic offers sliding scale therapy, and wherever you live in the country, there's usually a place in your area, a clinic that offers sliding scale therapy. So thank you for that resource, Lynn, and we will put that link on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hey, this is Mary Siafalo. I'm a retired therapist for the last 6 months. I'm 75 years old. I no longer want to keep an office going, but I am at the top of my game, as are most therapists when they retire, since it's experience that really teaches you. And I, for example, now I've heard about the Warm Line. I would love to volunteer. But what I really want to talk about is this untapped capacity with mental health people who retire, who could be used as volunteers if they were given some options and told how they, you know, could spend less time and not have to support a whole office, but still use the skills that they've developed over their lifetime.
Right. And I'll ask our guests in a minute, Mary, but since you're a newly retired therapist, how long have you been a therapist?
37 years. I had a private practice. I loved the work. I was sad to have to stop. And I mean, there's just something about it that can be so recharging and wonderful when you see people get better because they're getting the help that they need.
Right. And since you've been a therapist for so long, Mary, what changes would you like to see in this system?
I'd like to see insurance companies pay therapists decently. They pay less than half of their normal fee, usually.
Oh, wow.
And so a lot of therapists drop insurance because it's too full of hassles and you just don't get paid very well. I'd like to see that. I would like to see some kind of a catalog of services. It used to be years ago when I was in training at San Francisco Suicide Prevention, we had a Rolodex full of, back when people had Rolodexes, full of information. So somebody could call San Francisco Suicide Prevention and find out all the services that were available because they had somebody full-time who was keeping that catalog going. And now I don't know if there's any one place. Like, for example, I'm hearing about all these wonderful programs for the first time.
Wow.
Could there be one place where somebody could call and find out and not have to go through all the frustrations that you were talking about having to go through yourself?
Right. That, I mean, that speaks volumes, given that you've been a therapist for 37 years, and it's the first time you're hearing about this. Mary, would you stay on the line? And our producer, Laura, is going to ask you for your number, because we'd love to do a show with a roundtable of therapists about this issue, and I think you'd be a great addition. So thank you for calling.
I'd love to do it.
Thank you so much. Peter, do you have any recommendations for Mary and others who are retired therapists who would like to volunteer? And we're almost out of time.
Well, I heard Mary say that she might be interested in the warm line, which would be, I think, could be a great fit. We are peer run, so I'm not sure if Mary identifies as a peer, but that'd be a different conversation. But I want to give our website as well. It's mentalhealthsf.org, which is where folks that might want to volunteer for the warm line could find out about that, as well as we have a lot of a variety of other services as well through Mental Health San Francisco.
And in our remaining minute, both of you, you know, what can people do to advocate for better services? Peter, what would you say?
Well, I feel like for sure talking to local politicians. There is a Senate Bill 10 is being considered now in the California Senate, and this would allow for peer certification within California. We're one of the few states that doesn't have that, where it would codify the services that peers provide. So I feel like talking to local politicians is a great way.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. Kelly, about 30 seconds, what would you add?
On that note, I would say, especially California, there's so much happening in the mental health world there, is get involved with your local community organizations and politically, because that's where a lot of the decisions, that's really where the money comes from, right, is who decides where the resources go and how do we regulate it. Right. So I would get involved with state and local folks.
Well, we will definitely continue doing shows about this. Kelly Davis is Director of Peer Advocacy Support and Services at Mental Health America. It's a community-based nonprofit dedicated to addressing the needs of those living with a mental illness. Kelly, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Murphy is Outreach Coordinator for the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. They operate the Warm Line. The number is 415-421-1880. Peter, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rose. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And if you are in the Bay Area, we are doing a live show this Friday at 5:30 at Mission High School's Little Theater. We will be joined by Oakland writer Chizu Omori. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for all of your calls and emails today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.